The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
Florida and beyond, inside the GOP's Sunshine State slugfest, the blessing and curse of big money and how it was made.
State of Obama, what the State of the Union address said and did not about the president's plans for government and re-election.
The health care gap, Obama made only passing reference to his signature domestic reform, but problems persist with or without it.
The odds on Oscar, the Hollywood insider on last week's nominations, and some dynamics that will decide the winners.
Joni Leonard and Lauren, a young American, celebrates two of Canada's singular singer-songwriters of the 1960s.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of GateWave Incorporated, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of January 29th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
Governor Romney owns shares of both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Governor Romney made $1 million off of selling some of that. Governor Romney owns share and has an investment in Goldman Sachs, which is today foreclosing on Floridians.
But have you checked your own investments? You also have investments through mutual funds that also invest in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Right.
That subject really doesn't interest me a whole lot. The bigger issue here is these two gentlemen who are out distracting from the most important issues we have by playing petty personal politics.
The tables turned in Florida last week as Mitt Romney returned fire from Newt Gingrich more effectively than ever on matters ranging from personal finance to immigration to health care. Both men drew criticism from trailing Republican nomination contenders Ron Paul and Rick Santorum, but a small army of GOP insiders weighed in against Gingrich, and Romney opened a significant lead just days before what could be a defining Sunshine State primary.
Nationally, Gingrich still leads among likely GOP voters, but fares worse against Obama than any other White House wannabe. To talk about the most recent debates, the TV ad war and ground game in Florida, and the shape of the campaign to come, for your ears only, we're joined by Boston Globe presidential political campaign editor Don McGillis. Welcome to our program.
Good morning.
Gingrich got a second $5 million in super PAC support from the Adelson Casino family in Las Vegas last week, but many thought he seemed to have lost that in-your-face fire that helped him so much in South Carolina, maybe because he senses that conservatives are more mannerly in Florida. What's your view?
I think he was trying to act presidential, God forbid, and that did not stand him in good stead, certainly in the first of the two Florida debates, and then the second one, where he did have an audience that was allowed to be more responsive. He tried his technique of turning a question against the moderator, and Wolf Blitzer wasn't going to have any of it and turned it right back to him. And I think that somewhat declawed him in that debate.
What impact do you see from those negative notices on Newt from establishment Republicans who actually worked with him in Washington? Do they increase his appeal to Tea Party rebels but turn off at least as many GOP moderates and independents?
I'd love to see some good polling on that, because there is an anti-establishment, anti-elite feeling among Tea Party sympathizers and others, which was very evident in South Carolina. Maybe it's less important in Florida, but certainly some of that establishment rallying around Newt Gingrich, especially when you see, you know, Bob Dole and John McCain, who in the minds of some of these Tea Party supporters, these are seen as flawed, moderate Republican presidential candidates of the past, and in their minds, nominating Mitt Romney this time could be going down the same path. So to see them rallying around Mitt Romney at this point may not hurt Gingrich all that much among that part of the Republican Party.
Well, Mitt Romney's own fortune remains a major theme, from the under 15% tax rate he's paid to question marks over his bank accounts and tax havens, including Switzerland, Bermuda, the Cayman Islands. Do you see that as a continuing issue?
It's an issue, but it's a difficult one, really, for Newt Gingrich to make much of a fuss about, because his tax reform plan would reduce Mitt Romney's total tax obligation virtually to zero, because he wants to go to a zero capital gains tax rate. he can say what he wants about establishing the Mitt Romney flat tax rate of 15% and all, but under his plan, Mitt Romney would be practically home free.
Even more complicated, the Boston Globe did an extensive tax analysis noting the split within Romney's portfolio between arguably job-creating investments and hedge fund plays that are more like gambling. Is that all too complicated to make much a difference?
It's going to be difficult in a Republican primary for any of the opponents of Mitt Romney, I think, to single out those parts of his fortune that are being taxed arguably unfairly at such a low rate because, as I said before, basically that much of the Republican Party wants to do away with any kind of tax on investment income. If Mitt Romney becomes the Republican nominee, that will certainly be a lively issue, as we saw Tuesday night when President Obama gave his State of the Union address and started talking about this millionaire's minimum tax of 30%, which is roughly double what Mitt Romney has been paying now. And of course, Obama tied it to the so-called Buffett rule, Warren Buffett's point that he should certainly be taxed at a higher rate than his secretary, but because his income is predominantly from investment income, he gets taxed at a very advantageous rate. And so I think you're going to see that in the general election. It's going to be a much more, if Mitt Romney is the nominee, it's going to be a much more important issue then.
Rick Santorum has also noted that both Romney and Gingrich have supported elements of President Obama's health care reform, and most notably an individual insurance mandate to more evenly spread the cost. The issue hasn't helped Santorum much, but could it help Obama significantly in the general election?
It could, especially if Mitt Romney becomes the nominee, because try as he might to distinguish between Romney Care in Massachusetts and the Obamacare health plans for the country as a whole, they really do follow the same model, and it's going to make it quite difficult for Mitt Romney to be the proponent of repealing Obamacare during the general election campaign if he is the nominee.
Romney also has a record of changing his story on himself voting Democratic in the past, notably in a 1992 primary vote for Paul Tsongas. How did that happen, and how important do you think it is now?
This is an issue that could resonate in the Republican primary. In 1992, Paul Tsongas was a former Massachusetts senator, was running for president, and there was a contest also on the Republican side where the sitting President George Bush, the first George Bush, was being challenged by Pat Buchanan. So Romney had the choice then of voting in that Republican primary in Massachusetts or voting in the Democratic primary. And he chose to vote for Paul Tsongas, who made a name for himself as a deficit fighter, as a guy who would cross the aisle and work with Republicans to reduce the deficit. And that might have appealed to Mitt Romney, who up until that time had not been politically active, really. So he took a Democratic ballot, and that's being held against him. He said during the debate Thursday night that he had never voted for a Democrat when there was an option of voting for a Republican. Well, technically, that was wrong. There was an option for him in 1992 to vote either for George Bush Sr. or Pat Buchanan in that Republican primary.
Do you see any of the current contenders dropping out after Florida, whatever happens?
No, I don't, actually. As you mentioned in the introduction, Newt Gingrich has this flow of money from the Edelson family, and Rick Santorum has positioned himself, I think, to be the final conservative standing outside of Ron Paul. If, in fact, Gingrich's campaign does collapse, I think Rick Santorum still wants to be around to be the final person that sizable portion of the Republican electorate that has been relatively cool to Mitt Romney.
Don McGillis is Boston Globe presidential political campaign editor.
Quote from the news, "Every day I am working hard. I will recover and will return." That was the vow of Democratic Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords of Arizona in a letter of resignation as the House bade a bipartisan farewell to the still recovering victim of last year's assassination attempt.
Next, seals and the state of Obama for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. If the administration follows the law, there's no way they can continue the aid. That was Virginia's Republican Congressman Frank Wolf on human rights abuses by Egypt's military caretakers, even as demonstrators celebrated the first anniversary of President Hosni Mubarak's ouster. $1.3 billion in U.S. military aid to Egypt is now at risk as Congress debates the nation's democratic progress, or lack of it, including detention of foreign NGO workers, among them the son of U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. Now this.
Good job tonight. Good job tonight. This nation is great because we get each other's backs. And if we hold fast to that truth in this moment of trial, there is no challenge too great, no mission too hard. As long as we are joined in common purpose, as long as we maintain our common resolve, our journey moves forward, and our future is hopeful, and the state of our union will always be strong.
It wasn't until the next day that most Americans learned why Barack Obama praised Defense Secretary Leon Panetta last week on his way to the podium for a re-election year State of the Union address. The Special Operations Commandos of Navy SEAL Team 6, killers of Osama bin Laden, had just completed the daring drop-in, chopper-out rescue of an ailing American aid worker and her Danish colleague kidnapped in Somalia.
Obama did not mention the operation in his speech, doubtless to avoid distracting from his own more political mission, but he did stress military accomplishments at the beginning and end, both the end of bin Laden and of the U.S. troop deployment in Iraq. And he touted the military mindset of helping one's buddies above all else as the essence of American success and hopefully his own approach to government.
National Journal chief correspondent Michael Hirsch says military dressing may season much of Obama's reelection effort, not because international affairs loom larger than U.S. economic hardship, but because they are an area of more clear Obama success and an indicator of leadership strength and reliability, on which Obama hopes to capitalize as contenders for the Republican nomination shred one another's credentials. And to talk more about that strategy and Obama's State of the Union, for your ears only, Michael Hirsch is on the line now. Welcome back to our program.
Happy to be back.
Beyond bin Laden, remind us of the military achievements Obama's strategists want voters to appreciate.
The bin Laden takedown was just one of at least 22 out of 30 senior al-Qaeda leaders that the Obama team claims to have taken down on his watch. And in fact, if you talk to a number of terror experts, you often hear the assessment that al-Qaeda is really not defeated, at least severely set back. So, you know, he has that. I mean, this is the number one boogeyman from 9/11, Osama bin Laden, that he took down. He's also laying claim to some very wise strategic moves, a new toughness in dealing with Iran, a new geostrategic approach to reining in China's influence in Asia. And across the board, they're trying to convey a sense that this is a commander-in-chief you can trust.
You say President John F. Kennedy is the model they have in mind, in contrast with so many of his Democratic successors.
Yeah, it was interesting. That remark, the comparison to Kennedy, was made to me by Philip Zelikow, who is a senior counselor to Condoleezza Rice, George W. Bush's Secretary of State, and obviously someone aligned with the Republicans. So it was interesting to hear him and other Republican foreign policy professionals talk in such positive terms about Obama's record, in distinct contrast to what you're hearing on the GOP campaign trail. And the Kennedy comparison is particularly telling because it was really after Kennedy that Democratic presidents came to be particularly mistrusted on national security. The Vietnam War, decline of the Johnson administration, which oversaw the Vietnam War, really led to a lot of doubts about the Democrats and within the Democratic Party. And Jimmy Carter, the next Democratic president, was not much more highly thought of than LBJ was. Bill Clinton just had a so-so record. So it's interesting that you hear this assessment going back to Kennedy, who his accomplishments are perhaps more, they live on more in myth than actual fact, but nonetheless, he was credited with standing down Nikita Khrushchev during the Cuban Missile Crisis and being seen as a guy who was willing to use hard power, military power. And Obama is casting himself in that same light.
On the other hand, the strategy stresses an area of government operations, defense, that the president actually began scaling back last week with coming cuts in bases, force levels, pay and health benefits. Isn't that at least a political problem? And what's your reaction to the cutback plans?
Unquestionably, it's a vulnerability. But when Obama went to Asia, he promised that there would be no stinting on U.S. forces in that region, which is now part of this big new geopolitical focus. He announced an additional deployment of U.S. Marines to Australia for the first time. This is being seen as a benefit of the withdrawal plans he's announced from Iraq and Afghanistan. Obviously, he has been criticized for that. But I think that part of the strategy is to remind voters of the last Republican president, George W. Bush, and the reckless use of power. And that's what you hear from Obama campaign officials, things like, you know, in some ways, Mitt Romney, for example, they say, is even to the right of George W. Bush in taking a hard line. He refuses to negotiate with the Taliban in Afghanistan, of course, even at a time when many military experts and generals in the Pentagon say that there's no choice but to negotiate with the Taliban. So that's the message they're hoping to convey, one of responsibility and a moderate use of power.
Military references may have marked the beginning and end of Obama's State of the Union, but in between were more proposals for domestic government initiatives with or without congressional support and providing yet more targets for Republicans. What do you think were the most important of those proposals for fairness, for economic recovery, or just for Obama's campaign?
Well, I'm not sure which really was the most fair of those proposals, David.
But what in terms of the proposals themselves, do you think any of them are more than just political fodder at this point?
No, I really think that almost everything that Obama does and the White House does at this point is going to be about politics, you know, everything from its congressional strategy, which is one of essentially throwing plans out there on the economy will be, you know, turned down, turned back by the Republicans in the House, just by way of showing that he's trying. I mean, there's no question that he has shifted to a fiercely partisan approach. I think you're going to see that continue. But I do think that with just a so-so case to make at best on economic recovery at a time when, you know, the latest numbers show the economy is not charging back, it's just barely coming back, the commander-in-chief strategy is going to become more and more important. And that's something of an irony for Obama, who you may remember in the 2008 primaries, it was none other than Hillary Clinton who was raising questions about Obama's suitability to be commander-in-chief, and now they're putting it out there as one of his great strengths.
Michael Hirsch is the chief correspondent for the National Journal.
Quote from the news, patients were brought into us in the middle of interrogation for medical care in order to make them fit for further interrogation. That was Christopher Stokes, general director of Doctors Without Borders, suspending some medical efforts in Libya and joining other aid and human rights organizations to complain about torture tactics by the new regime.
Next, the singular domestic achievement which the president barely mentioned, health care reform, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. I'm not saying Iran will not react, but it will be nothing like London in World War II. That was a retired Israeli official voicing the growing government consensus that a military strike on Iranian nuclear facilities would not trigger a suicidal counterattack. Tehran, meanwhile, threatened to terminate all oil exports to dependent European nations even before the summer embargo they agreed on to sanction Iranian nuclear development. Now this.
I will not go back to the days when health insurance companies had unchecked power to cancel your policy, deny your coverage, or charge women differently than men. I'm a Democrat, but I believe what Republican Abraham Lincoln believed. The government should do for people only what they cannot do better by themselves and no more. That's why our health care law relies on a reformed private market, not a government program.
That President Obama's re-election year State of the Union address made only passing mention of his signature domestic policy success, health care reform, was perhaps understandable. The Affordable Care Act, with its universal personal insurance mandate, is far from universally popular. Only 42% of Americans approve. And it faces a high hurdle in March at the Supreme Court, with a decision due before Election Day for better or worse.
But the state of health care is an unavoidable factor in the actual State of the Union, with 40% of American households now struggling to pay their medical bills and costs rising endlessly. Veteran health care journalist Steve Jacob takes a nonpartisan look at the country's health care future in his new book, Healthcare in 2020, where uncertain reform, bad habits, too few doctors, and skyrocketing costs are taking us. And he's on the line now for Your Ears Only. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Kat. I appreciate that.
Were you surprised at the president's near avoidance of the topic during his State of the Union address?
Not especially. From my vantage point, I think he thinks it's already done. He thinks that health reform is on the way, it's going to get done, and I think to me that was sort of a presumptive approach on his part. You know, it was interesting right at the top of this piece where you played back what he said during the State of the Union. There was a blogger on the Journal of American Medical Association site the other day that said that out of almost 7,000 words of text, only 44 words were spent on healthcare. And that's like 0.6% of the text, and that's as opposed to the last couple of years where, you know, it was almost 7% of the entire speech. So, you know, healthcare has receded as an issue. From Obama's perspective, he thinks it's done, and he thinks he's going to get reelected. And then Republicans, you know, Mitch Daniels, who's done quite a bit in the state of Indiana, also pretty much ignored the issue, too. So we're sort of in this interesting interlude where people are waiting to see what the Supreme Court does and then also see who the nominee is.
Critics say health care reform plays to Obama's vision of big government, not to the interest of American citizens. Others say his reliance on private enterprise makes the medical insurance marketplace the biggest beneficiary. What's your view?
My view is that essentially a lot of these ideas have sort of been labeled or relabeled. The individual mandate was born as a Republican idea in the 1990s, and so was the health insurance exchange. You know, the whole idea that insurance companies would compete for everybody's business. So, you know, from my perspective, I'm not so sure whether you consider it a big government thing or whether you look at the aspects that are, in fact, introducing competition within the healthcare industry. So it's sort of not all one or the other.
If Obamacare survives the Supreme Court, you write that the U.S. healthcare landscape will change more in the next decade than in the last 50 years. In what most noticeable ways?
Well, I think what's most noticeable is what health reform does do. There's a lot of things it does not do, but the one thing it does do is essentially nearly wipe out uninsured Americans. Certainly there are going to be certain pockets of those. Certainly undocumented workers can't get insurance. But, I mean, that is the first time really in American history where nearly everyone will have access to health insurance. Now, how affordable that will be, we'll see. So that's really the change with health reform. But I think the bigger changes are going to be the fact that we're going to have real problems with access to physicians, because so many more people are going to have health insurance, plus the fact that we've got an aging population. And then it's also the fact that these skyrocketing costs are not going to be altered at all by health reform. They might actually accelerate them a little bit.
What kind of companies are most likely to stop offering health insurance once private health exchanges are widely available as a source of policies?
Well, I think the companies that are most likely to are the ones that right now offer it but don't really need to on a competitive basis. And what I'm thinking of is sort of low-wage transient workers. If you look at the retail industry, if you look at the entertainment industry, if you look at the hotel industry, those kind of folks are pretty much, in some of the service and wholesale industries, I think they're going to look at the economics of this thing and say, look, we'd rather just pay the penalty than have to pay health insurance benefits.
Both political parties agree that health care is too expensive, but you write that 30% of all medical care delivered today has no benefit to the patient. Why not, and what kinds of care in particular?
Well, if you look at over the last 10 years or so, there's a lot of certain procedures that are being done that weren't done 10, 15 years ago and are done two or three times more often. You know, MRIs, certain kinds of scans. And the population health has really not changed that much. So what we're seeing is an awful lot more procedures because the technology is there, and because it will in fact be paid for either by the insurance company or the Medicaid or Medicare providers, go ahead and do these procedures. Let me give you one example: angioplasty, where they put stents in your arteries. If that's done within 24 hours of a heart attack, that may well save your life. But if it's done after 24 hours, it doesn't do anything. But there's still a significant percentage of these expensive and invasive and potentially dangerous procedure that's still being done that science says is of no benefit. And there's many, many, many things across the healthcare industry that are sort of like this.
Veteran journalist, editor, and healthcare columnist Steve Jacob is also an adjunct professor at the University of North Texas School of Public Health. His new book is Healthcare in 2020, where uncertain reform, bad habits, too few doctors, and skyrocketing costs are taking us, from Dorsum Publishing.
Quote from the news, what did we learn today? Things are bad and they're not improving at the rate they want them to improve. That was Kevin Logan, chief U.S. economist at HSBC Bank, on the Federal Reserve's promise to keep interest rates near zero until late 2014. Overall growth advanced by 2.8% on an annual basis, fastest pace in 18 months, but a little weaker than expected.
Next, an insider on Oscar, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
And I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. People who come to Grantham are more interested in Isaac Newton. Did you know he invented the cat flap? That was Lauren Hall, a therapist in Margaret Thatcher's hometown, where a controversial Oscar-nominated film about her life, The Iron Lady, has drawn sporadic interest and mixed reviews. Now this.
Hooray for Hollywood! You have no way of knowing who made good.
Perhaps you'll be another Papa Dion, your name in neon. If you get lucky, you could.
Yes, buddy, you'll arrive if you can top this five. Hooray for Hollywood.
Hardly an Oscar season goes by without some riffs by Johnny Mercer and Richard Whiting from the 1937 film Hollywood Hotel. It's always appropriate at this point in the process, when the nominations for Finest Work in Film have just gone public and nobody knows for sure who'll win. But doubly apt this year, when the two top nominated entries are homages to film itself. Leading the pack with 11 nominations is Martin Scorsese's Hugo, disinterring a French cinematic pioneer. Following with 10 nominations is The Artist, set in Hollywood's silent black and white era.
This year we have an insider's odds on the race. He's stage, screen, and TV director Michael Lindsay Hogg, son of Hollywood star Geraldine Fitzgerald. Lindsay Hogg was last here for Your Ears Only to talk about his recent memoir, Luck and Circumstance, a coming of age in Hollywood, New York, and points beyond. Also, the mystery of an Orson Welles connection. Welcome back to the program.
David, delighted to be here.
I gather that a great number of nominations in various categories is not always a good omen, sometimes serving as a kindly substitute for the actual Best Picture Oscar. Which categories do you think are the best predictors? Director, screenplay, some other?
I think director probably, screenplay and actors are the best predictors, certainly more than the 10 nominations now which are coming for the film. Partly, I think those 10 nominations grew out of a discouragement that Hollywood had that very big grossing pictures weren't being nominated, like one of the Batman pictures, I think. I think director is a very good indicator.
Well, only 5 of the Best Picture nominees are also nominated for Best Director.
Right.
Hugo, The Artist, The Descendants, Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, and The Tree of Life. So would you say they have a better chance than The Help, Moneyball, War Horse, Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close?
Yeah, I do think so. And I think that the best, if for my money, the Best Picture will come out of the Best Director list.
Some around Hollywood were surprised to see Extremely Incredibly, a post-9/11 heart-wrencher, nominated for Best Picture, as it had been snubbed by many pre-Oscar awards. How important are those competitions, like the Golden Globes, in deciding actual Oscar votes?
Well, they're kind of like a horse goes to the post with a certain amount of money already wagered on him, and it looks like the odds are good. They're not really that big an indicator, I don't think, because the Oscar voting groups are quite independent. Yes, if someone seems to be really on a path, having won all the other awards, that's a very good predictor. But this year, a lot of the awards have been split, Screen Actors Guild and Golden Globes and stuff like that.
You say sometimes factors far from what's on screen have a conscious or sometimes unconscious effect on votes in the Motion Picture Academy. Sometimes just a feeling that someone's time has come, and you feel that way about Clooney's Best Actor chances in The Descendants.
Yes, I do, because not only is George Clooney a wonderful actor, he was very good in The Descendants, but also because there's a kind of aura about him of being decent, funny, intelligent, attractive, humanitarian. And when the chance comes to give him a leading actor Oscar, I think this will be his year. He not only deserves it as an actor, he deserves it as a man in the Hollywood community, too.
Among the nominees for Best Actress, only the relatively little-known Viola Davis is in a film, The Help, also in the running for Best Picture. And you see her as a strong contender, along with Michelle Williams in My Week with Marilyn, and most nominated ever, Meryl Streep in The Iron Lady. But do all those past nominations work against Streep if her film was not seen as a top contender?
No, I think what will work against her this year may be the fact that Margaret Thatcher, for a lot of people, isn't as well known or is interesting still, or doesn't keep any of the history that she's got in England. Meryl Streep was wonderful in that movie, but Viola Davis is such a brilliant actress. I first saw her in the theater in a play called Doubt. She did the film as well. I think it may be her year, because Meryl Streep has been correctly so rewarded over the years. I think it might be time to give her a pass on this one.
Does Christopher Plummer's advanced age make this more his moment for supporting actor in beginners than the relative beginner Jonah Hill in Moneyball?
No. Well, I was interested in getting Christopher Plummer to be in a play this September in New York, and he's booked up for 2 years solid. So I think his advanced age will keep advancing. I think the performance was so wonderful. And again, it may be his time again for an Oscar, because he's been around in theater and film, you know, for 60 years doing wonderful work, although Jonah Hill was terrific in Moneyball.
You were on a TV show with Rooney Mara, who had the edgy title role in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and you found her one of those actors most unlike the role she's known for. Talk about that and the degree to which roles are a kind of psychotherapy sometimes that actors get paid for.
Yeah, I did Jimmy Fallon for my book, Luck and Circumstance, and Rooney Mara was on just before me. And she seemed, in public anyway, very shy, not forthcoming, kind of unavailable as a person. But then in Girl with Dragon Tattoo, she's this dangerous, darkly alluring presence. And so it's very interesting to me, the dividing line between the actor as human being, and then when the actor, again, who might be shy or diffident in what you might call real life, goes into the movie or on stage, they become a totally different person. And maybe that's their real person, which is the fictional person.
I heard TV's David Milch asked recently if he gave advice to Dustin Hoffman about playing a role in the new show Luck that Milch based on his own father. He said that would be like telling a river how to run, Hoffman being such an intuitive artist. What are your rules of thumb for directing top actors?
Give them their head. I think David Milch's comment is very good. I mean, certainly for sometimes younger actors, you want to be able to suggest they go left and not right, as it were. But I've been lucky enough to work with some very great actors, Geraldine Page being the greatest. I did a lot of stuff with her. Let her guide you as much as trying to push her in one direction, because the great actors like Dustin or Geraldine or perhaps Christopher Plummer, they have a scent for the part, for the character, like a hound finding the truffle.
Stage, screen, and TV director Michael Lindsay Hogg. His new memoir is Luck and Circumstance, A Coming of Age in Hollywood, New York, and Points Beyond.
Go out and try your luck, you may be Donald Duck. Hooray for Hollywood.
Hooray for Hollywood.
Now this quote from the news. The trail has grown cold on a lot of these cases. That was Jeff Conaton, a former chief of staff to Senator Ted Kaufman of Delaware, about the task force that President Obama announced would pick out additional Wall Street villains in the mortgage crisis.
Next, Joni, Leonard, and Lauren for Your Ears Only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. His words, "I should have done more, I think I'll keep in my memory." That was Larry Foster after the death of his friend Joe Paterno, the iconic Penn State football coach, from lung cancer at age 85, only months after being fired for not doing enough about a report that defensive coordinator Jerry Sandusky had sexually assaulted a young boy in his team's showers. Now this.
It's coming on Christmas, they're cutting down trees, you know, they're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. So I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, you know, it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money and I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river I could skate away on.
It was a truism of the 1960s, I always thought, that very few could perform the songs of the fabulous singer-songwriters like those artists themselves, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, Janis Joplin, Paul Simon, Leonard Cohen. But I was truly impressed several weeks ago to hear not imitation but interpretation by a young singer-actress named Lauren Fox nailing the mood and manner of the Joni Mitchell classic River and others.
Fox has created a whole tribute show to a pair of those legendary performers, both Canadians, not coincidentally. It's called Love, Lust, Fear, and Freedom, the songs of Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen, which she brings back to Manhattan's Metropolitan Room in February. And she's on the line now to talk about it for Your Ears Only. Lauren Fox, welcome to our show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What was it about Mitchell and Cohen that drew you to focus on them and their work?
It's very simple. They're my two favorite songwriters. I actually discovered both of them when I was a child. My father played me the Judy Collins album Wildflowers, and she had done several of their songs on the album, and I was obsessed with this album when I was a child, and specifically obsessed with Both Sides Now, Suzanne, Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye. Those were the songs that stood out. And I believe Sisters of... Actually, Suzanne wasn't on that album. It was a different album. But it was Sisters of Mercy was on that album. And it wasn't until later that I discovered them, actually. I was in my early 20s, and I discovered them as solo artists, their own music. And I fell in love, and I've been in love ever since.
Talk about their relationship with one another, brief but with lingering effects on both.
Oh, well, they had, in the summer of 1967, Judy Collins actually introduced them at the Newport Folk Festival, and they had an affair. They dated for a couple of months, and it didn't last, but it affected their songwriting. Joni wrote a whole bunch of songs about Leonard, and certain aspects of his songs kind of have little hints of his experiences with her. So it's fascinating. When I started to actually research the lyrics, it all came out, you know, all the little hints and clues.
Well, do the songs of Mitchell and Cohen share equally in Love, Lust, Fear, and Freedom, or how do these qualities divide between them?
I named it Love, Lust, Fear, and Freedom because I think it's those four words really sum up both of them. Although I do think Leonard has a little more cornered the market on lust a little more, and maybe Joni's got the love part a little more. But both of them have that same conflict in their lives and in their music throughout their lives. They both dealt with a lot of inner conflict and turmoil when it came to love and freedom. They're, you know, the fear of staying with one person or being trapped or not being able to express themselves fully because there was somebody hindering them.
Joni Mitchell eventually departed, briefly at least, from singing her own songs to standards from the Great American Songbook, the 20s, yeah. 30s, 40s. Have you got an opinion on how she does in that territory?
I think it's incredible. Someone as brilliant as Joni Mitchell at lyrics can interpret anyone's lyrics. And certainly the Great American Songbook, those lyrics are perfection. So I think she did a wonderful job. I really do.
And what kind of music and other art has Leonard Cohen been making in his later years?
Leonard is still doing music. He's still he's actually got an album coming out on January 29th, and a new album. And he's I hear there's a rumor that he might start touring again. Amazing, right?
Your next musical project moves south from Canada to California's Laurel Canyon, but also in the 60s. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay, it's called Canyon Folkies. And it's a history of the decade between the mid-60s and the mid-70s. In Laurel Canyon, there was this incredible, magical movement going on where Joni Mitchell, Jackson Brown, James Taylor, Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, the Mamas and the Papas, the Byrds, the Lovin' Spoonful, the Doors, the Eagles, the list goes, Carole King, the list just goes on and on and on. And they were all there at the same time, creating and young and full of this incredible creative energy. And they were creating and collaborating and dating. And it was just this magical time in this beautiful place.
Have you been there yourself?
I have. I lived in Los Angeles for years, and Laurel Canyon was one of my favorite places. So I have a very personal connection to it. I actually lived there for a little while as well.
Lauren Fox brings her show of Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen songs to Manhattan's Metropolitan Room February 1st and 16th, and maybe later to a room near you. Meanwhile, here's a bit more of her singing Mitchell.
I want to have fun. I want to shine like the sun. I want to be the one that you want to see. I want to knit you a sweater. I want to write you a love letter. I want to make you feel better. I want to make you feel free.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. The last thing we want is for our hard work to be undone each day in the school cafeteria. That was Michelle Obama on new administration requirements for better nutrition in federally supported school lunches, including double the amount of fruits and vegetables, only non-fat milk and whole grains. French fries and tomato sauce on pizza as a vegetable remain.
For Your Ears Only is online at YouTube, iTunes, and PodcastBunker.com. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donation. Email davidearsonly@gmail.com to pledge.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan. With interns Kaimana Larson and Rachel Murray, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern, acknowledging support from the nonprofit Gatewave Radio Reading Service, the century-old Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Rachel Murray. This week, last year, we noted the spreading wildfire of Middle East protest, already jeopardizing the 30-year rule of Egyptian strongman Hosni Mubarak. From our January 30th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by David and Eddie Robinson.
Continue to call on the regime to understand that they better be listen quickly, not use violence, and understand that change has to come. There's no other option.
Street protests continued last week in Tunisia as demonstrators demanded removal from government of all veterans of the regime they had already ousted. More dramatic still were similar demonstrations the Tunisian uprising sparked, heavy with disaffected but internet-connected young people in places as different as poor Yemen and powerful Egypt, where Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei returned to help lead the reform movement. With flame and tear gas adding a sense of history in the making, 30-year Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak announced he would form a new government, but not exit himself.
The confrontations in Egypt were a challenge both to Mubarak and to President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. They value Egypt's support in the region, but also see the danger of opposing a true democratic uprising and the opening that could give to anti-American Islamist forces. To talk about the ideology, technology, and diplomacy at play, For Your Ears Only, we're joined by Jean-Pierre Filliou, historian and Arab expert at the Institute of Political Studies in Paris, currently a visiting professor at the Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. His books include Apocalypse in Islam and The Nine Lies of Al-Qaeda. Welcome to our program.
As we record this week's show, we see escalating conflict in Cairo and reports that al-Baradei might have been detained or at least kept from leaving a mosque he had visited. Are you surprised at the speed with which the spirit of Tunisia was picked up and escalated in Egypt?
Honestly, yes, but like everybody else. But at the same time, I was in Egypt on April 6, 2009, when a single Facebook group was able to just shut down the city by calling for a virtual strike that turned very real. So there was a potential, obviously.
What do you make of Mubarak's plan to replace his government, though not himself?
Well, you know, after so many days when Egyptian officials said we are not going to give any concession because that was the way it started to go down for Ben Ali the moment he conceded anything, well, obviously they understood at least part of the message from the street and they got ready to make a move. But let's assess what is serious and deep is that move.
Is al-Baradei a likely political leader after years at the International Atomic Energy Agency and other overseas postings?
Of course, he's a person very respected in Egypt. His main liability, I must admit, is that he's not spending time enough in Egypt. The fact that he had to come back to join the movement, that he was not inside of the country, being at the heart of it, is already a sign of that. But one has also to see that in Tunisia, as well as in Egypt, it's not a leader-led movement. It's basically amorphous movement with a very significant youth factor, internet Facebook factor, and they're not doing that to support this man or that man. But certainly a national symbol will be needed to embody the alternative if there is an alternative in the picture.
In Tunisia, we heard reports of the army refusing to shoot fellow citizens. In Egypt, we heard about police shedding their badges and uniforms to join the crowds. Now, does this suggest a greater interior opposition than we knew?
Well, first, the strongest ministry in Tunisia was and still is Ministry of Interior, while in Egypt it is a defense. So the fact that the army in Tunisia refused to shoot the demonstrator was also a way as a weak party to join the protest movement. In Egypt, the contrary. The main issue would be if in the military in Egypt, people decide not to go after the demonstrators, and until now there is absolutely no sign about it.
What role in the uprisings or their aftermath do you see for the Islamic parties, whose commitment to continuing democracy is very much a question to many Americans?
You know, I'm French. And in May 68, during the student uprising, the Communist Party was pretty much against the student leftist and pacifist. And it was, in fact, a conservative party when it came to law and order. By many standards, the Islamist parties today are playing the same game because they are afraid of this movement. They don't know a thing about it. They can't manipulate it. It's coming from places they have no idea about. So two days ago, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt tried to join the movement, but even on that day, they were only a small part of the picture. They are not behind the movement, and probably they won't be the first one to benefit from it.
Was the government shutting down the internet a master stroke or an admission that the Mubarak cannot coexist with the essence of modernity?
By doing that, they're certainly on the very short term, maybe 24 to 48 hours, buying times. But it's pathetic because it shows once more that they are trying to wage a war of the past against their own people. Because anyway, Al Jazeera is broadcasting the news. Anyway, people are aware through phone and cell communication of what is happening. So even if there is not the plus of the internet, they will still be protesting, and they have been, even after the ban on internet.
What role for dissent in the region has been played by the WikiLeaks revelations of corruption and Washington's awareness of it, complicity for geopolitical reasons?
this is basically a Western issue. It has been very much debated over there, but nothing was surprised, and nobody learned a lot from those WikiLeaks. It was much more an issue in America or in Europe. So I don't think one should overvalue this factor and this surprising. It's basically Tunisia that was the spark of this regional movement. And because Tunisia was and is still so modern, so advanced socially and in terms of education and roles of women, in a way, it played quite a pioneering role in what we see all over the region.
What is your appraisal of the Obama administration's response to the uprisings, first in Tunisia?
Well, in Tunisia, the Obama administration was very decent, and I think its behavior all along the crisis was very respected by all the Democrats, especially the praise of the courage of the Tunisian people in front of the repression. Now the challenge is much higher for America in Egypt, because it basically it is a key partner in the region for America, certainly, especially after the Obama speech in Cairo in June 2009, but of course in the peace process with Israel. And immediately this will give a new dimension to any response to the democratic movement.
Jean-Pierre Filieu is a historian and Arab expert at the Institute of Political Studies in Paris, currently a visiting professor at the Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. His books include Apocalypse in Islam and The Nine Lives of Al-Qaeda.
Mideast Wildfire. From our January 30th, 2011 broadcast, after a series of half measures, Mubarak finally did step down. As many feared, however, various Islamist groups proved far better organized politically than the secular protesters, winning control in parliamentary elections. But the military caretakers had been quicker with rhetoric than real surrender of power, even holding hostage the son of U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood and several other pro-democracy NGO workers, and jeopardizing $1.3 billion in U.S. military aid. I'm Rachel Murray. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, more of Lauren Fox singing Joni Mitchell.
I am on a lonely road and I am traveling, 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 looking for something. What can it be? Oh, I hate you some, I hate you some, I love you some. I love you when I forget about me. I wanna be strong, I wanna laugh along, I wanna belong to the living. Alive, alive, I wanna get up and drive, wanna wreck my stockings in some jukebox dive. Do you want, do you want, do you wanna dance with me, baby? Do you wanna take a chance on maybe finding some sweet romance with me, baby? Well, come on. All I really, really want our love to do is to bring out the best in me and in you too. All I really, really want our love to do is to bring out the best in me and in you. I wanna talk to ya, I wanna shampoo ya, I wanna renew you again and again. Applause, applause, life is our cause. When I think of your kisses, my mind seesaws. Do you see, do you see, do you see how you hurt me, baby? I heard you too, then we both get so blue. I am on a lonely road and I am traveling,
fantasy. The creed is the unraveling, it's the unraveling, and it undoes all the joy that could be. I wanna have fun, I wanna shine like the sun, I wanna be the one that you wanna see. I wanna knit you a sweater, I wanna write you a love letter, I wanna make you feel better, I wanna make